45 years ago tomorrow, April 22nd, an estimated 20 million people took the streets in the first ever Earth Day, brought together by then-Senator Gaylord Nelson. And that Earth Day came out of the Vietnam War movement, came out of the radical movements of the 60s and exploded. He thinking he could take the energy of young people and put it into the streets. It was an amazing moment in our history. It was a moment when two things that we were part of our conversation was the then head of the United Auto Workers, Walter Reuther, the man who put the cars on the road. At that moment was happening, all the cities were deeply polluted. People could hardly breathe in their neighborhoods. The Cayuga River caught on fire in Ohio. There was a gigantic oil spill and a gasoline explosion off the coast of California. These things all kind of happened at that moment and pushed people towards these environmental issues. But it was Walter Reuther, who was head of the UAW at that moment, who got up and said, we have to do something radically different. This is the man, auto workers president. I keep saying that because what he said was, we have to stop building all these cars and start building mass transit for America to help get rid of the pollution. And so this is a kind of far-thinking human being at that moment. And a lot of African-American leaders were torn about this movement because some saying we can't distract from the struggle around racism and poverty in America. Others saying in that movement, no, this can help build the movement and make it broader completely. So a lot happened on that day around Earth Day 45 years ago, and we're going to wrestle with what happened then, what it means for now, and where it could be taking us. We are joined here in studio by Sasha Jones, who is food justice consultant, for the Park Heights Community Health Alliance, and manager of the Afia Community Teaching Garden in Park Heights. Good to see you once again, Sasha, as always. The Reverend Merrick Moyes is with us, ordained minister, writer, community activist, teacher, one of the first African-Americans ordained within the old Catholic movement in Baltimore.
Good morning.
Have you back, Merrick. Fred Tupman joins us by phone, Patuxent Riverkeeper. Always good to have him with us. Fred, great to have you here.
Great. Back.
And Gerald Weingrad with us, who was is attorney, adjunct professor at the University of Minnesota School of Public Policy, where he started a graduate course in Chesapeake Bay Restoration since 1988. But he was known when he was in the Maryland State Senate as the conscience of the environment in the State Senate, and has never lost his nature to fight for the environment and for environmental justice. And there's people call him sometimes Gerald Take No Prisoners Weingrad. He's with us as well. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can log on to our Facebook pages, and you can email us at talk@steinershow.org. But, Jerry, let me start very quickly with you. You were there in 1970. You almost were part of this movement, were waylaid by the Vietnam War and the draft. But tell us about that moment.
Well, I was a young cub just out of University of Maryland Law School working for the National Wildlife Federation in Washington, D.C., and I was sent with a task to go to Gaylord Nelson's meeting, Senator Nelson's, in the in the Senate, and we sat kind of in folding chairs with a group of environmental folks and leaders and people from different groups and had a briefing. I think it was around early February, 1970, about this Earth Day. And I thought, well, sounds like a good idea. I don't know how they're going to do this nationwide. And it was this bright, shiny idea, and who had any clue what it would blossom into. But unfortunately, or fortunately, I was commissioned in the United States Navy JAG Corps. I was going to be drafted, and I was an attorney, and I loved my job in D.C., but I had a duty, and so I was in Newport, Rhode Island on April 22nd, 1970.
So let me talk about the significance of that moment. I mean, the United States was in an environmental crisis, and so laws were passed around air pollution and water quality. They were actually pushed through the Nixon administration, which he balked at first, but he was forced to do it. And the Democratic Congress pushed these certain things, and it did make, in many ways, our country a little healthier environmentally than other parts of the world. When you visit other parts of the world, you can feel it and see it. But we're a long way from health in the environment. So I wonder, let me start with the younger people in this room first, in this conversation. That would be Sasha Jones. And just because I'm curious, because you, as a younger person, you came to this, and you can tell us how, this whole world of the environment and farming and health that you've come into. Mm-hmm. And we're not around in 1970.
Certainly.
Weren't even an inkling in somebody's eye in 1970, right?
My parents were yet children and hadn't met yet.
So talk a bit about what that Earth Day means to you from 45 years ago and how it relates to your world today, especially in communities like Park Heights.
That's an interesting question. I I came to in the environmental movement having the privilege of traveling abroad and seeing just the connectedness in terms of environment that we all share, you know, in the world. So I went to Nicaragua, and that was my first trip abroad. I was 17, and I got there, and I'm like, wow, this is amazing. You know, it's lush, it's great, you know, all this farmland and all these beautiful people, and found out that their largest export was plastic bags at the time, and they were the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. So there was a real disconnect between their land resources and their political power and access, you know, and that was a whole different thing. But coming up kind of civically engaged here in Baltimore, I went in with that lens of, you know, like, how can we change things? How can this be great? So fast forward to now in Earth Day, I was completely changed by that trip, and it made me want to be an active worker on the ground to actually start connecting people to the resources they already have so that they can, you know, be invested in the environment and to benefit from the environment. You know, we were able to hike the Andes on that trip, and, you know, it was glorious. You know, you see coffee trees, you know, just kind of growing. And all types of trees and sugarcane and all that. And that changed for me. So when I came back, I immediately wanted to recreate that experience. But in recreating that experience, I feel like I don't have time to celebrate Earth Day, you know. So for me, because I work, you know, managing the garden and keeping, you know, our food programs going, and, you know, organizing our CSA, which we are an open enrollment, shameless plug. But in organizing that and just maintaining the work and being a worker in the movement, I don't necessarily take time out to say, oh, this is Earth Day, and mm-hmm. I have to commemorate Earth Day. And, you know, like, the history hasn't even been kind of shared with me. So in reading, you know, the materials for the show today, I learned a lot. And so I think there's a real disconnect between the history and where Earth Day started and the momentum and the feeling on the ground. And I love that you connected it to just coming out of civil rights era, just coming out of, you are still being in the midst of it, really, you right. know, just, you know, being in the midst of Vietnam and all this groundswell, you know, that has not, I don't think, it's trickled down to the generations for us to say, wow, this is not just, you know, let me buy a reusable shopping bag and go to the farmer's market today or this weekend. But really, this was a movement that brought people from all walks of life together to bring some lasting change, both on the ground and at the policy level. And so I think that has been lost throughout the generations. And I appreciate this conversation we're having.
So Fred Tupman, I mean, just, you know, as a riverkeeper, and as someone battling for the environment, but also as someone who's really active in the Black world and community around these issues, I'm curious where this takes us now, 45 years later, from your perspective. I mean, we saw the movement, this movement, as I said earlier, as Sasha just reiterated, was born out of the movements of the 1960s, the environmental movement was. But now we're here 45 years later. So, I mean, your analysis as well about to where this takes us, because you live and see it every day, as does Joe Weingrad, in the disastrous conditions that the waters around us are.
Well, it's a funny contrast, because I think of the birth of the environmental movement as a cognizable mass movement occurring in the 70s, as the civil rights movement was basically kind of declining from its heyday in the 60s. And I got involved with environmentalism because I thought of it as an extension of civil rights. I think of pollution and polluting as economic crimes that have kind of social economic implications. Mm-hmm. And yet, here we are some 40-some years later when, you know, the environmental movement is still struggling, I think, to try and find its connectivity to basic human rights causes. I think there's a little bit of fuzziness about that sometimes within the mass environmental movement about whether, you know, civil rights sentiments are even relevant to it. They ought to be. There's no question in my mind that they are. But I think we're a new movement. I think that's really key. We're a relatively new movement. 40 years is not a lot of time for us to kind of find our leg. But we're still struggling to figure out exactly who we are as a big movement. And again, what our connection is to these great, you know, powerful causes that are so inspirational and so powerful that really should be uniting people. And we could do a much better job, I think, of uniting people around environmental issues.
I have to give a shout out to Mr. Tupman. I met him last year or 2 years ago in Annapolis. And we were sitting in a hearing or some type of forum. And I remember him saying to me that there's a lot of racism in this movement. Mm. Then it's not going to be overt. Please keep your eyes open. Mm. And as soon as he said that, I had my antenna up and my spidey sense really trained on what I could bring back to my community. And what I realized was that he was absolutely right, because oftentimes when the rubber meets the road in places of power, the voices of those most affected by environmental blight and environmental destruction are unfortunately not represented in these halls. So I think that one of the challenges that the movement faces is, what does it look like when the people most affected by the blight, by the environmental degradation, are not the ones in the halls of power? They are not. And then the movement itself, how can it grow when the people who are leading the movement don't look like the people that are actually affected? And what does it look like when the demographic, when we know that that people of color are growing demographically, but the movement does not represent that growth? And what does that look like politically? Does that look like if the movement does not reach out and actively recruit and train leadership that looks like the people who are affected, does that mean that the movement will be on the wane? So we need to figure out, as Mr. Tubman says, how to connect the dots. Because I've got kids here in Baltimore that are suffering from asthma, whole families, and we know air quality is poor. Mm-hmm. But where are their voices? Who is representing them in the halls of Annapolis when we're calling for clean air legislation? It can't just be me and somebody else. It has to be other people, other voices. And I would also like to see the church en masse get involved, because there are churches that are getting involved. But I'm talking about specifically churches that are in communities of color that are seeing these things and can really be vectors of communication for communities, for them to get involved.
Jerry, I know you've been hearing everything that people have been saying, and you've been around the environmental movement a long time, and we've had a lot of programs here just about the changes in that movement, how it's getting younger, and also how many more people from black and brown communities in this country are kind of taking hold of leadership, and where you see us now, where you see us going.
Well, one of the early criticisms of the environmental community is still relevant today, that it's a largely white movement, white employees by the vast majority, and a much lower percentage than the population of minorities as a whole. And that still holds true. One of the readings that you all sent out was exactly on that point, and it's very still disturbing. I made an effort with former Senator Larry Young, who was a delegate with me when I started in the General Assembly in 1979, and we tried to do an exchange thing where I'd come to Baltimore and talk about environmentalism with his people, because just as one of the other speakers said, disproportionately minorities are affected by urban blight and by hazardous waste and landfills and dumps. It doesn't happen around the wealthy and the affluent, and it doesn't. The air pollution is worse in the urban areas where folks suffer from asthma, as just was mentioned, one of the students. So I see that was one of the real, real bad developments that occurred, that we have not advanced minorities in positions of leaderships and in the environmental community, whether it's in the grant makers, the mainstream environmental groups, or even in the environmental agencies at the state and federal level.
But let me tackle a couple issues here and see where you all think we are in terms of 2015, 45 years after that time. And I was thinking about that, because that's the year that my first daughter was born. It was in 1970. And so a long time ago. And where we are now, and I let me just take one issue here and a couple of issues. Let's just talk about Maryland for a moment. The four of us, the four of you, and talk about where we are. And let me talk about an issue that may not be directly related to what we just talked about in some levels, but I think affects us all, which is I have always called the people, the paving contractors of Maryland, and the developers, the kind of defense contractors like they are on Capitol Hill. They are the power they hold here to, on the local level, to have zoning the way they want you to build whatever they want to. And to change nature society, whether it's coming into Park Heights and moving people out and moving people with money in to take over those houses, mm-hmm. or whether it's tearing down the forest to build new land every time they want to expand out. And the question is, that to me, I'll let you start on this, Jerry, we'll go around the room, because that to me is kind of a fundamental question on how you begin to control what happens around us and how we develop community, but also how you don't destroy the environment in the process. And I remember, Jerry, once you shared in the show, years back when you were here, I remember one day you said, we should not allow another house to be built or another tree to be cut down or something similar to that.
Well, the way the process is skewed in this state is so distortive of what needs to be done. We are zapping the energy and strength of our existing people and infrastructure in urban areas like Baltimore City. But even more strikingly, when I was teaching my graduate course on the Chesapeake Bay, is when I put the demographic together, it is really appalling what's happening in our state. And that is that it isn't just Baltimore City, but when I looked at the census data, 161 reported municipalities in the state, almost 40% of those were losing population. And it didn't make any difference whether it was Western Maryland or the Eastern Shore or Southern Maryland. When you looked at small towns and other municipalities, they were actually losing population or gaining much less than the county or the state as a whole. And that's because all of our policies support development wherever it goes, not just because of the lobbying power of the industry, but because that's the way the system works. Any growth is good, and it zaps. Baltimore County sucks out big corporations, small corporations, and businesses, and also jobs out of Baltimore City. So does Anne Arundel. So does Howard County, Harford County, all the surrounding counties. People are moving. My relatives, where I grew up when I was very young in East Baltimore, they live in Harford County. They live in Baltimore County. They're out of the city. And so we're bleeding our cities of the people and the vitality. We're closing libraries and police stations and fire stations and schools in Baltimore City while we're spending state and local money to build the same schools in Baltimore County and Harford County and Anne Arundel County and Howard County. It is crazy. And so until we change that dynamic and revitalize our urban areas, which not only protects the environment, it ensures the lifeblood of our cities, and then we don't have the crumbling infrastructure and the high tax rate in Baltimore City. Baltimore City, again, after 2 years of bumps, where for the first time in decades they actually had small increases in population, the decline is occurring again out of our city. So that's one of the most foremost problems that we have. And I want to interject one other quick thing.
Okay.
When you look at the Earth Day, start to realize this. When that first Earth Day happened, we in the world had a population of 3.7 billion people in 1970. We now have almost double that. We have 7.3 billion people on Earth. And in Maryland, it's similar. It's more than doubled since that period of time, and we're dealing with a lot more people, and the way they move is much more land consumptive, and the way they develop land, and they don't want to live in urban centers generally, where our urban populations have been bleeding population for the most part. Washington, D.C. has reversed that. So we're dealing with a lot more people, and the state just seems to be oblivious. Smart growth doesn't work. The Plan Maryland was actually a farce. It really didn't change anything. And so we were faced with that dilemma with a suffering population as well as with incredible tax consequences.
Fred, why don't you jump in on that?
Gosh, I mean, I don't even know where to start. I mean, I couldn't add a great deal to that at all, to be honest with you. I mean, I agree with Jerry. Sorry. Sorry, Jerry, I agree with you.
Well, I mean, but to put that a little further, I mean, I think that that's part of what we're facing here is we don't, you know, whether it's, we talk about climate change all the time, and climate change is a really huge issue for us to face in this world and the world around us. But part of what I remember pushed the anti-pollution movement around the environment in the early 70s was health, was what was happening to us because what we breathe in, mm-hmm. what we take into our bodies, what we the chemicals that lace our food, that's in everything we eat, and all that, Sasha, are the kind of things that I think motivate in a different way, are motivating younger people, your generation a little older, into the movement because mm-hmm. they're seeing, it's not, you can't see it, you can't see the smog as literally as you used to be able to see
right.
it, but you can feel it and you can see what happens in our diseases and what happens in our communities. And that's part of what I think is pushing people now.
Right. I would definitely agree with you. We are not as motivated by holes in the ozone layer and, you know, like uranium and plutonium. Like, we're not interested in those things anymore. In the large aspect of it, my generation is definitely concerned with, you know, viability. Do we have the opportunity to thrive, you know, and our ambient quality is at a point where, you know, it still trumps those of, you know, the rest of the world. But there, in terms of environment, I did want to point out that both environment and climate both have these social connotations to them. You know, the environment can be the ambient quality, the water, air, all of that, but can also be the human capital, the dynamics that are in the community, how a community works. And that also is the environment. That's the climate of the community. So in the environmental movement, you know, you spoke slightly of displacement and how the environmental movement has kind of changed and shifted. And so in Park Heights, I was just thinking about my community. You know, the first Earth Day was in 1970. You know, that's around the same time that Park Heights started to get its first African-American, you know, citizens. And the 40 years or 45 years from then to now, the community has completely gone downhill. And so in talking about the environmental movement for people of my generation, we're concerned about what was not included when this conversation started. And for me, a lot of, you know, it started thinking about, you know, clean water, clean air, clean waterways, you know, that type of thing, and holding big business accountable, which we still have a long way to go. But now we're seeing these negative offsets or negative externalities of even the environmental movement. And it's with, you know, when we have the environmental movement without the lens of racial equity or without the lens of economic equity and how the environment affects everyone differently, even though it affects us all, you know, you get these uneven changes, or you get the people who are leading the movement, like you were saying, Merrick, the people who are leading the movement completely out of touch with the folks on the ground either doing the work or the folks on the ground who are affected by these policies. And so I'm finding that young people are more motivated by that, being on the ground and doing the work, you know. And I've had the privilege of working at policy organizations. I've had the privilege of working at some of the larger environmental organizations that have been around since the 40s and 50s. And they are always focused about the animals and the water. And, you know, and for young people like myself, especially people of color, we're most concerned about, is there going to be a way for us to eat? Like, you know, is the water going to be equitably distributed? Is it going to be privatized, you know, when it becomes too scarce? Like, those type of economic, social equity, social justice thoughts and, you know, of the environmental movement.
We have to take a quick break here. We're coming right back from this break. I want to pick up on Sasha's point and have all of you jump in, because I will posit here on the way of the break that there is a direct connection between the climate change in our world and how and what's happening to destroy our Earth via climate change, what's happening to our water, to our air, the extension and power of the oil industry, and what happens in the poorest communities in our country that are directly affected by this. The question is there a way to bring all those together?
Mm-hmm.
If we take a quick break, we're hearing the voice of the wonderful Nina Simone. Don't let me be misunderstood. She passed away on this day in 2003. We'll be right back.